So good afternoon. Welcome to the Ambulance Science Podcast. This is Scott Phelps. And like usual, I'm here with Maria. Last name unknown, Maria Werner. We're going to call her that today because we can. Whatever, it sounds Germanic. So if you call her, you know, I'm not going to make up any German names because that never turns out well.
Oh, it was actually changed on Ellis Island. It used to be Vina and it was changed to Werner. So we are not German at all whatsoever.
Okay, good.
Fun facts.
I could stay out of that minefield right there. So today what we were going to talk about was the criminal prosecution of paramedics. And, you know, it's been in the news and you've seen it in all the journals, all the podcasts about the paramedics in Colorado who are charged with, a whole variety of things. They threw the kitchen sink at them. We're going to get to that case. But first, I want to talk about an earlier case, not much earlier, but a similar case where you had paramedics, actually, they're Canadian paramedics, primary care paramedics, so they're the equivalent of advanced EMTs, in Hamilton, Ontario, charged with negligent homicide. That's basically what it comes down to. It's a little bit different, but not really that different. You know, the Canadian legal system, at least outside of Quebec, is almost identical in most ways, other than some of the terminology, compared to the US legal system. And this is a case that was just tried this summer. And like the criminal prosecution of the paramedics in Colorado, it was one of the first cases of criminal prosecution of paramedics for the provision or lack of provision of care in Canada. And it's important because they have been convicted, although they have not yet been sentenced. The sentencing is going to be in October, but they have been convicted by a judge of basically what amounts to criminally negligent homicide. And both medics face a prison term of up to 5 years in jail. So Maria, have you ever heard of a paramedic even being charged, let alone convicted, of a crime when at work based on the care provided or not provided?
I feel like it's more likely to hear that care was not provided than that it was provided poorly. I think overall they have a hard time, unless your documentation is really poor or you documented something completely grossly negligent. I don't hear a whole lot on the news that says people were tried and convicted of, you know, say a crime regarding their care. No.
And the reason why is because there's not many cases. But yeah, as a lawyer and a paramedic, I've argued for a long time. We need more civil cases in EMS. Because boards of medicine don't find physicians incompetent and take away their licenses very often, no matter how bad they are. What stops incompetent physicians from practicing in general is they become uninsurable because they've lost too many medical malpractice claims. And right. Without being insurable, they don't have any place to work. So.
Yeah. They don't usually convict the medics themselves or even try the medics themselves. I feel like they might call them in as a witness to the case of whatever it was, but because the care continues to the hospital, if there was some sort of suspicion that something was not handled appropriately, they technically have to look at both the pre-hospital and the hospital side of it. So I feel like the paramedics are not usually singled out like this. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's correct. And you're right. That the care is a continuum and the care has to be considered. And frankly, in the Ontario case, it's not considered at all. It's literally, there's literally like a wall where none of the hospital care is considered But in Ontario, there's a justification for that, and we'll explain that later. So I've generally been someone who's a proponent that we need more civil litigation on EMS because civil litigation drives quality. So when you get people convicted in civil court of not having provided appropriate care, that's where the system develops responses to ensure that that doesn't happen again. The problem in EMS is there's almost no litigation for negligence or gross negligence, depending on what the standard is, whether you're a career or a volunteer, it varies quite a bit. And as a result, there's not a lot of drivers of quality, whereas in medicine, the threat of medical malpractice drives an enormous amount of the quality initiatives that have happened. So for EMS, people generally think that it's good to have a very high bar to sue EMS clinicians. And I understand how it makes you feel better to be protected in that way. However, if you're interested in system quality, you'll realize that litigation actually does drive quality in most circumstances. So with that said, let's tell a story here. So you've got two Canadian primary care paramedics, Christopher Marchand and Stephen Snidely. This case was tried in summer, over the summer, where they were charged by the Crown with basically criminally negligent homicide for not providing appropriate care to a young man named Yosef Al-Hassanwi. So Yosef was in mosque, and he was 19 years old. He was a college student. Outside of mosque, there was a fight, and he went to go break it up. And there was a scuffle. He chased after some guys who, I guess, were, you know, beating on somebody else. And he got shot in the stomach. So objectively, he was shot in the stomach with a .22 hollow point bullet, which lacerated at least two arteries in his abdomen. So Yosef bled out from those two arteries, and he died. So, but going back to the case from the paramedics' point of view, so the paramedics were dispatched, you know, Hamilton's a pretty suburban place. Both medics didn't have a huge amount of experience with shootings, people being shot. So when they responded to this call, they were told by more or less everyone that Yosef had been shot with a BB gun. So you know, when you're on a scene, how quickly rumors start to replicate, and then you're hearing it from basically all different sides. So they heard it from the fire service at the scene. They heard it from the police at the scene. They heard it from bystanders at the scene that Yosef had been shot with a BB gun in the abdomen. And he had a 1.5 by 1.5 centimeter wound in his abdomen. They described it, and this is one of the things that didn't help them, as a penetrating wound. I assume they palpated it. His abdomen was soft and untender. They didn't say whether they palpated the area around the wound to try to feel for a BB. I know that I've had patients who were shot by BBs before. I've had friends who were shot by BBs before. And if it does enter the skin, it usually doesn't travel very far. So usually if someone's shot with a BB, either it hits them and bounces off, doesn't have enough force, or if it goes under the skin, it's usually right there. You can feel it. It's a hard BB. It's not hard to find. It's not hard to see. Regardless. So literally the medics heard from pretty much everybody that he was shot with a BB gun. So the scene was dark. It was chaotic, according to the people's, of course, there was video because this is 2021. Even the brother of the victim said, at least initially, that he saw the shooter with a small silver gun in his right hand. He described the gun as a pocket gun, like a modified pellet gun. So you could see how in this type of setting, your initial impression would probably be, just because you're hearing it from every corner, that it probably was a BB gun. Now, I'm not saying whether that was the right thing to do, but you certainly can understand how people would believe it, right?
Like, like confirmation bias, you know, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and you're like, all right, cool, I don't know anything about guns. You know, this is what I see, this is what I'm hearing. Okay.
Exactly.
Me personally, my friends didn't have BB guns when I was a kid. You know, that wasn't like a culturally acceptable thing in my generation. So, you know, I don't have a lot of exposure to that either. So I might've been just as gullible. Like, I think as a paramedic, we have this bias when we read some of this stuff. And for me, I always think, okay, could this have been me? And then I have a little bit more, you know, insider, whether you call it sympathy, empathy, or whatever, for these people. Yeah, because if you're being told something on scene and you want to take it at face value, you don't know something to contradict that information otherwise, then you take it at face value because that's the only information you have. I mean, we have it on our skill sheets in New York State on a trauma scenario. It says attempt to get a sample from people on scene because that's the only place you're going to get one. So, you know, in a way, we're trained to do that in a sense, right?
And that's where a lot of our information comes from. And I'm trying to be neutral to the extent sort of possible. But I agree with you. Like, my belief was always, maybe not right when I was brand new, but yeah, after a couple of years, my belief was that the finger of fate could touch down on you at any day and you could lose your license over literally anything. There's too much going on. There's too many variables. Even if you were clinically 100% on target 100% of the time, which, you know, just isn't possible because we're all human, you're still in a situation where you could just get screwed. You could end up on the front page of the New York Post at any time. And for good things, for bad things, you know, it's just your fate. So let's keep on going with this. So once Yosef was shot, he walked back to the mosque, sat down on the curb, was talking to family members and friends, mostly in Arabic, but also in English. And the director of the mosque heard him say that he had been shot in English to the paramedic, to Marchant, and that he was having difficulty breathing. And there was general discussion. So they had already bought into the pellet gun story. So when they have a, you know, 19-year-old who was shot with what they thought was a pellet gun, who was carrying on saying that he was having difficulty breathing, you can guess what his response was. Maria, what do you think his response was? His generalized response to Yosef saying he had difficulty breathing and that he had to be rushed to the hospital. What do you think the medic's general take on that was?
I guess that if you really believed it was a BB gun, you might categorize it as maybe anxiety or something versus it being, you know, something that's a penetrating or, you know, cavitating injury that's causing a lot of harm inside, you know.
But you've hit the nail on the head. They classified it as an anxiety. They commented that he's acting, he's a fake, he's carrying on. And this wasn't, it wasn't that they didn't provide care to him, but they just thought he was acting out after this BB injury. Now, you know, here's the problem.
Which looks the same. It looks the same as respiratory distress. So, you know, at first glance, someone breathing fast or, you know, maybe guarding the abdomen or things like that in a situation like that. I mean, that could be misleading, but we're also taught to treat for the worst case scenario in the spectrum and then narrow in from there. So it's hard to say.
Did you read this whole case? Because you seem to have this down pat, right? You seem to know all the where it's all headed.
It's like you sent it to me.
It's almost like I sent it to you. So the dispatch, police dispatch, the EMS dispatch basically said we have a man with a superficial wound to his abdomen, shot with a BB gun. So their dispatch information, all the information they got from Urbanicine, said it was a superficial wound. As they go through it, so they think he's got a superficial wound. They think he's full of it. So at some point, his brother goes, gets his arm, you know, his arm around Yusuf and goes to stand him up to bring him over to the ambulance. And when that happened, the medics just basically said, okay, let's go over to the stretcher. So they actually just put his their arm around him on the other side, I guess, and they brought him over to the stretcher, put him on the stretcher, and put him into the ambulance. Now, they didn't go rushing off to the hospital. They said, let's shut the doors. I'm not sure they shut the doors, but I'm going to make a assumption they shut the doors. And so let's get a better assessment, which I think is objectively reasonable, right? So you want to get him out of the public view. You want to get him into the truck, the door shut, so you can get a better sense of what's going on. So they do that.
Yeah. And crowd control. I mean, when was this? This was still during, you know, quote unquote COVID times that we're still living in, right? So
9 o'clock at night, but there's a bunch of people outside. It's a very chaotic scene. It's dark out.
Yeah, get them out of the environment, you know, because whether it was a BB gun or, you know, an assault rifle, the hysteria on scene can be completely the same. And so you want to remove the patient.
And that's what happened. So they got him out of the environment. They did an electrocardiogram. I'm not really, okay, that's fine. They think he's just upset. They don't think he has a serious wound. Okay, that's fine. They take vitals on him. They palpate his abdomen. His abdomen is soft and non-tender, not rigid. And they're trying to decide where to go with him. So in Hamilton, Ontario, they called the dispatcher about availability at hospitals, and they wanted to take him to the primary psychiatric service hospital rather than to the trauma center. Because they honestly believed that he did not have a serious penetrating injury, that he had primarily an emergency psychiatric problem. And so the dispatcher technically has the final say on this because the dispatcher knows the resources at each hospital at the time and basically said, okay, go to the local hospital that has psychiatric services. So that was what they were going to do. So here's the problem. When they take his vital signs, this is where I start. You know, up until now, I can put myself in their shoes. Here's where it stops a bit. So his heart rate is 144. Yeah, that was the eyes. You can't see this because you're going to get the audio. That's where Maria's eyes went boing. So 144, they couldn't get pulse oximetry reading, but that happens a lot of times, especially with the physio monitor. It seems to happen more than it probably should. He was speaking in 3 to 4 word sentences. He, at the same time, he was pulling off the cardiac monitor. He was pulling off the oxygen. Was he hypoxic? It turns out, yes, he probably was hypoxic, but you know, he also just could have been combative from a variety of other reasons. In this case, it turns out it was hypoxia. So what do you think they do then? You have someone who has a rate of 144. Like, honestly.
Tell me they restrained him.
No. See, they didn't restrain him. They didn't put him in 4 points or anything. But
okay. Well, there's that at least.
But there's that, exactly.
See, they could have restrained him. That would have been worse.
But with a rate of 144, you know, even if I thought he was, you know, maybe if I thought he wasn't necessary, if I had been led down that same path they were at, when I get in the back of the truck and his rate's 144, that's when I'm going to start changing my decision. And it's actually
changed the plan. It's okay to change the plan.
Yeah, it's actually mentioned in this case that, you know, he had a, they had a confirmation bias, they had an anchoring bias, all that's true. But boy, a rate of 144. That's where I start. That's where I start getting start losing my. I have a hard time seeing how I'd be on that same path now.
This is where you reaffirm that you're happy you're not a defense attorney.
Well, you know, listen, I still work clinically as a paramedic. So honestly, like, this could happen to me and this could happen to anybody. The question is, where do you start saying, well, this isn't fitting the pattern that I've been expecting. And so that's when you say, okay, well, let's change things. So they called the hospital, told them they were coming. They did actually, it says they restrained them, but I have a feeling they just strapped him in tight. They didn't actually restrain him per se. So after the first time they told the hospital they were coming, Yosef became unresponsive and now has a heart rate of 45 beats per minute and a blood pressure reading of 90 over 60. So I gotta be honest, those numbers don't gel, right? Like, why does he have a pulse of 45? If he had a pulse of 145, and it was 90 over 60, I'd understand, but a pulse of 45. And even if he's sort of, you know, you could say he's just breathing down, he's hypoxic, blah, 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 except he's 19. So, you know, they generally don't sort of get bradycardic with a
blood pressure of 90 over 60. Yeah, he wouldn't crash like a pediatric
patient. You know, if he had a blood pressure of 90 over 60, even if we knew he was traumatized, we probably wouldn't, you would probably not give him any fluids, right? Like 90 over 60, we'd be like, that's still permissive hypotension. Like, he's going to still be perfusing his vital organs here. So that fact that he was Brady at 45, I'm not really buying that. You know, you'll see like the monitors do a lot of wacky stuff. And I feel like this is one of those wacky things, the monitors.
Yeah.
Do.
If you're driving fast too, sometimes, you know, the pulse ox will go all over the place. And meaning the heart rate on the pulse ox will go all over the place, or it won't read, or, you know, it'll read really fast because it's averaging. So I'm wondering if maybe that was a disconnect too, like on the Brady side where like it wasn't really picking up, or someone wrote it wrong. I don't know. Is that coming off the monitor, or we don't know?
I'll bet. I don't know for sure. I'll bet $100 that came off the code summary. Cause that's what you see all the time. So, you know, they go to the psychiatric hospital and the kid died, right? The kid had a penetrating wound with a low velocity, hollow point bullet, which severed two arteries. He bled 2 liters of blood into his abdomen. And they don't actually consider the hospital care. And I do find this interesting, but when they point out how the law works in Ontario, it's not about causing the injury. It's about the deprivation of a chance for survival. Does that make sense? It's not about the outcome. It's about the actions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of why they didn't care about any of the hospital care later on, mm-hmm. because that...
Yeah, he was at the wrong destination.
So the wrong destination, he did, I assume he had some sort of at least emergency physician surgical intervention, even though it was at a trauma center.
Right.
And the guy died.
Yeah, I think the system's probably different there too. Like, most of the places that I've worked in the tri-state area, at least, if you're going to take them to a really good trauma center, a lot of those really good trauma centers also have psych. So I wouldn't have to pick between the two if I had like a suspicion one way or the other. But I can't necessarily say I would have made the same decision because I wouldn't have been faced with that choice between those two destinations. But that being said, like, it's a lot easier to transfer someone to a trauma hospital and be wrong and then have them send them out to psych after they make that determination than it is to bring them to psych and then have them transfer them to a hospital that needs trauma. So
that probably happens 10 times a day, literally, right? Like, you take them to the trauma center and then they get discharged from the trauma center because it turns out things weren't what you thought. For whatever reason.
But we'd rather that happen 100 times than have this happen one time, you know?
Yes, yes. But I just always feel like there, but for the grace of God goes to me. So here's the section. So this is what they were convicted of. So they were convicted of failing to provide the necessaries of life as codified in Section 215 of the Criminal Code. Everyone is under a legal duty to provide necessaries, there's no T in here, necessaries of life to a person under his charge if that person is unable by reason of detention, age, illness, mental disorder, or other cause to withdraw himself from that charge and is unable to provide himself with the necessaries of life. They had a legal duty to do so, blah, blah, blah. There's a couple of things here. And here's what the judge found. They found, first of all, that the accused were under a legal duty to provide the necessaries of life to Yosef. From an objective standpoint, they failed to provide the necessaries of life. And from an objective standpoint, their failures endangered the life of Yosef. So, like here in the U.S., like I said, Ontario law isn't radically different than law in the States. They use a reasonably prudent paramedic standard. So the question is, would a reasonably prudent paramedic have made the same decisions and would have provided the same care to Yosef? Now, part of my problem with this is that in order to determine what a reasonably prudent paramedic would do, what do you need? What do you need to testify?
A reasonably prudent paramedic.
A reasonably prudent paramedic. And part of the problem here is that in the way they produce cases in Ontario is they produce a summary of each element. And it's actually pretty well written out. It's not a narrative. It's narrative, but it's narrative in paragraphs. They only have one paramedic testify, Hamilton's former chief paramedic. And he doesn't testify point blank that that a paramedic wouldn't have provided this type of care. Mm-hmm. They have testimony from several different physicians, including a physician who was in charge of the Sunnybrook Paramedic Center in the Greater Toronto area. That's sort of like the big medical control base traditionally.
Yeah.
But they only have one paramedic testifying and they don't actually establish the elements. So if I was an Ontario lawyer and I was given this case on appeal, at least part of my argument would be that there wasn't sufficient testimony from other paramedics to establish that these elements weren't deviated from what a reasonably prudent paramedic would have done.
I'm not sure if it's totally fair to pick somebody from the same department either, because there might be bias there one way or the other to say, oh, of course, if I was the person in charge here, I would have done the right thing. Like, you know, because it's like you're trying to compare apples to apples, but they might also know each other. You should really pick someone that doesn't know them. That's more objective instead of subjective, right? In my book, I mean, pick somewhere close to there so that they have the same transport decisions if you have to, but I don't think you can pick them from the same department and not expect there to be some sort of bias.
Yeah, this guy who testified was the deputy chief of the Hamilton Paramedic Service in 2017. So he apparently, it's hard for you to parse some of these timelines, is that he was their boss's boss, right, at the time. So he wasn't a line paramedic. And he actually was an advanced care paramedic, not a primary care paramedic. So there doesn't appear to be any testimony from another primary care paramedic that this was a deviation from what a reasonable primary care paramedic would have done, which I think is problematic.
Yeah, just like logistically, and I guess, you know, on paper, you know, if you're comparing, I think that it would have been a stronger testimony if they had someone that was, you know, and a quote unquote kind of equal, you know, objective counterpoint to that situation where you could say, what would you have done? And probably get a couple of people, not just one.
Yeah. So this is just one of, you know, physicians are not paramedics. Mm-hmm. Physicians may oversee the clinical medicine provided by paramedics, mm-hmm. but they're not paramedics.
Right. Unless they're trying them on the stand and trying their license as well as the paramedic certification or license. I mean, I don't think that's fair, right? Because if you look at an EMT, if an EMT didn't do CPR well, at least a paramedic is still an EMT. But I think we would still refrain from having a paramedic testify saying, oh, well, I would have done this better, et cetera, because we have a higher level of medical knowledge.
I just think it's because the standard is what a reasonably is the care was a deviation from what a reasonable paramedic would do. I think you are required to have that testimony. And they just doesn't. They don't have it. It's not the verbatim transcript. It's the case decision with all the stuff that goes into it.
Right.
But I don't think it's there actually.
I'm not really following the psych thing either. Cause it's like, if he had no evidence of an injury and everyone's like, yeah, he's crazy. He definitely didn't get shot with a BB gun or anything else. And he's just losing his mind. I could kind of see the psych thing. But if you have someone with a visible injury of any kind and people confirming that even if it was a BB gun, I don't see why you would take them to the psych center. That's what I'm having trouble understanding.
Well, it's not that it's not like what you're used to, psych centers being separate psychiatric emergency rooms. I don't think it is. I think it's actually an emergency room that has a large psychiatric service. So he did receive emergency care, emergency medical care, but it was not at a trauma center. And that just jumped around. So I'm pulling this down all the way to the bottom here. So there was three elements here that the judge found that the paramedics were liable for, and each of these met the elements. So the judge concluded that the erroneous belief about Yosef's wounding condition may have been honestly held. Such a belief under the circumstances presented that night was objectively not reasonably held. Now, you would agree with this at a certain point, and I would agree with this at a certain point, but I think it was at least reasonably held until the point where they got him into the ambulance and his vital signs were out of whack, right? Seriously out of whack. The judge found that the actions of the accused in the care of Yosef amounted to a marked departure from what should have been expected from a reasonably trained primary care paramedic. Number one, they failed to conclude that Yosef was suffering from a penetrating wound to the abdomen and thereby treat his injury as a load and go situation of the highest emergency, which required immediate attendance at a trauma hospital. Now, I'll agree with this sort of overall, but I'm dividing it between two points in time. So I'll just leave it at that. They also acquiesced and participated in inappropriate lifts. I don't think there was
kind of weak sauce because we move people quickly all the time just to transport them quickly. Like, because it's a cost benefit analysis.
There is, but there was significant. And like I said, the brother started to pick him up and the medic came under the other arm and picked him up on the other side. They moved him to the stretcher. there was testimony testimony from a number of different people, from trauma surgeons and from that deputy chief paramedic, I believe, that basically said that if they're shot, they should be scooped onto a board and not be moved around a whole bunch, which I understand, and I understand, but at the same time, that's someone who's never been at the scene of a shooting, right? So
it's hindsight, you know, it's always going to be 2020.
Well, it's correct even, but the problem is that's trauma surgeons aren't at the scene of shooting. So in theory, that's right. In practice, sometimes it's, you know, grab them and go however you can. And finally, they delayed in leaving the scene. This one is true, but I also think it's almost backwards, right? They got him into the ambulance. They wanted to give him a more thorough assessment, and they did. It did take, they were in the ambulance for, I don't have the timeline in front of me. I think it's like 15 minutes, which is a longer time than I would probably be super happy with. But he's pulling the stuff off. They're trying to secure him.
Yeah, if he was agitated, he could have been fighting them about, you know, getting belted. And that tends to soak up time sometimes that you don't realize.
Yeah.
So that's the only other thing I could think of that might.
So as you go through this, the judge found him guilty. The judge found both medics guilty, and they're going to be sentenced, like I said, in October. And my guess is that they've been convicted. That I'm not sure they're going to actually be given significant amounts of jail time, but. You know, their life is ruined by this one night. And I don't think they were trying to be malicious. You know, were they careless? Possibly, right? But I don't feel like they were malicious in what they were trying to do.
I'm almost wondering if there's a cultural component to this. So because he's from a minority group, the patient, maybe they're looking at it as more malicious because they might have thought that he was targeted or classified with this anxiety or overreaction based on the scene or anything like that. You know, like I'm wondering if maybe the conviction came about more harshly due to those kind of surrounding circumstances, like if they blew it off for any sort of biases they might have had.
You know, that's completely fair. And that's part, I'm not saying that it is, how can I put this in a way? The zeitgeist at the time for both this case and the Elijah McClain case happened at a very particular point in time in, North American political history. So there's that. I mean, you get what you get sometimes, right? Like you get caught up in the times, and maybe it wouldn't have happened exactly the same if it was a different time and a different place, but it didn't. It happened then, right? As it turns out, the guy who actually shot him got off on a technicality. And yet the paramedics have been convicted of what amounts to criminally.
That was the most ironic part of it for me. Like, because it's, you know, you're going to charge the people for not providing perfect medical care. But then the people that actually caused the injury which led to the homicide, I almost wonder if he got off easier too because of maybe the negligence. Like, so maybe they thought, well, you know, he wouldn't have died if he was given proper medical care, so we can't blame the guy who shot him. Like, maybe that was almost like the reverse mentality. So it almost like had a cause effect both ways. You know what I mean?
Well, so, you know, when I first started reading these, like I wasn't there. And this is, as I've gotten older, that's become a lot of my attitude of, I wasn't there. So, you know, there's a movie, I think it's called Sliding Doors, where it shows you like the same set of scenarios, same situation, like from four different viewpoints. This is always the way life is, right? There's multiple different perspectives on, was this right? Was this wrong? Was this a mistake? Was this negligence? Was this, you know, purposeful? And you take things in the context of the time where they happen. But when I started thinking about the outcomes of this, the other thing I know is that people respond to external forces. So what do you think is going to happen now in Canada, or at least in Ontario, whenever you have somebody who has any sort of cut, laceration, puncture, anything? What do you think the paramedics are going to do now?
I think they're going to take almost everybody to a trauma center that has an injury.
Yes. What's it going to do to the trauma center?
Well, the hospital where the trauma center is located, I think the ED is not going to be very happy with that, because they're going to have to down triage people and they might have, you know, nowhere to put them. I think on the flip side, people might be happy with the shift because it's a better safe than sorry approach, but we're going to have a similar situation to like what we have in COVID, where once you overwhelm somewhere, it's going to have other ripple effects.
Yeah. So the person who actually, the person who's actually shot is going to have to, you know, wait while they have 30 other soft tissue injuries in front of them, because this is, paramedics are going to respond to this by taking every single person with an injury to a trauma center. And they're going to take them lights and sirens, and they're not going to wait to do a thorough assessment, because this is the reasons why these guys are getting or were convicted. People will respond in a rational way, and the rational way is going to be taking everybody to a trauma center, period.
Right. And vice versa, you know, if there's a conviction here, and they get, you know, prosecuted, tried, et cetera, then that's going to influence precedent in the courtroom as well. So people are going to be even more afraid of being in that position because now there's a precedent for it.
Sure. So everybody goes to a trauma center, and this is what you're going to find. You know, yeah, there's an article that talks about, it was on CBC, Canadian Broadcast Corporation, how it may change healthcare. And, you know, it treats what would otherwise be regular civil malpractice as a criminal act. And so one of the things that sort of got in my head is when I'm reading this testimony from these trauma physicians and this ED doctor about how these paramedics didn't follow their clinical protocols, that's going to come back on them. They're going to be in the exact same boat where they're going to, at some point, they're going to be criminally charged for not giving the sepsis patient, 20 milliliters per kilogram of fluid. No matter what they needed it or not, they're going to be criminally charged because of some bad outcome happened.
If you have a medical malpractice case for a physician, should it come up, is that considered civil or is that considered criminal?
That's civil. And so that was the point of this article by Christine Rankin, was that if you're going to treat malpractice, which we previously defined almost exclusively as a civil issue, and we're going to make it criminal. And worse than that, we make any deviation from protocol criminal, because the medics did treat him. The medics did take him to the hospital. They just didn't bring him to the trauma center. What you're going to find is that, this may be the one-off, but this opens the door for any malpractice to be treated as a criminal event. So that's one case.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a good precedent to set. I mean, maybe sometimes it is, but it should be really limited criteria to me. You know, like not something like this. This should be tried civilly, something like this, in my opinion.
You know, like I said, it's not that I don't have an opinion. It's not that I try to stay in the middle ground for things necessarily. It's just that I do see both sides of the story. I just see the implications for the system from these types of decisions. It's not maybe it didn't need to happen. This might be a one-off. It might never occur again. This might be a shot across the bow. There might be, an overture of political, social, racial, ethnic, whatever implications to go into this, but I just see these sort of things having a huge impact, not just on the lives of everybody involved here, because of course that will, but on the entire system, because you end up in a position where people respond to people know this stuff happens, and then they react appropriately. Right. So. In Colorado, Elijah McCain, this is another case of somebody who is basically minding his own business. He was walking home from the store with his headphones on. But it was, it doesn't have the date on it here. It has probably has the date on this one. So the criminal.
September 1st.
Now, the criminal case was brought in 2021, but the event happened in August of 19. So that's an awful long period. If you know, even before the indictment was handed down, there was
COVID delay, maybe, I guess.
Or... No. Case was pretty well known, and it was being discussed for a long time that, there had been no charges against anybody in the death of Mr. McCain, and it had been going on for a while, and then in September, they just literally a week and a half ago, they handed down this indictment against the paramedics. There's a lot of things about this case that are kind of weird. Let's start off with what happened. So Elijah McCain was, I don't have the whole thing in front of me because I have the paramedic stuff. But if I remember correctly, Elijah McCain was walking home from the store, headphones on. He just went to bought. I don't know what he went to the store to buy. Was walking home, was pulled over by the cops. He basically wasn't doing anything. So I'm not even sure why he was stopped. But then I'm not sure if he was just...
It says he was wearing a ski mask. And so like a bystander called 911 for the cops because he looked suspicious being in a ski mask.
Yeah, however, wearing a ski mask is not illegal. And wearing a ski mask is not... Of course.
Yeah, no, that's... I'm just reading the article.
Yeah, it's not illegal. I mean, it's not really a crime. And so, like, when you... I don't want to get into sort of the law enforcement part of this, but basically... I'm not sure whether he was a very, very much an introvert or very much borderline autistic, but he basically, when the officers tried to interview him, he just basically was just like, leave me alone. And he hadn't done anything, and they didn't have it will be decided whether they had a legal right to detain him. It doesn't seem like they did. And then they called the cops were wrestling with him. They got him handcuffed. They called for the medics, and it was both a private ambulance and Aurora Fire Department fire medics. And they get there, and now this is the part I don't really get, because if you read the whole story, when the medics got there, he wasn't fighting. He was handcuffed and on the ground, and he wasn't fighting. But the cops had been fighting with him, but they're not, they weren't fighting with him then. And so the cops basically said, you know, he's just, you know, completely uncontrollable. And then they wanted the medics to give him something to chemically restrain him, chemically sedate him. It depends on how you want to characterize it. And what happened was the Aurora Fire Department paramedics talked to the, you know, actually Aurora Fire Department medics, Jeremy Cooper and Peter Chakudinik, actually, they didn't have ketamine. So they had to wait till the private ambulance got there, and they got the ketamine from the Falk ambulance crew. That's the private ambulance service that serves Aurora. So they got the ketamine from the Falk ambulance crew, who were not charged with anything, which I find kind of weird. They gave it to ketamine to Mr. McCain. They did not.
I have so many questions.
I know, so many questions about how this works.
It gets worse and worse.
So they overestimated his weight by a lot, and they gave him the ketamine. So they gave him more ketamine because they overestimated his weight than maybe they should have. And then they wait till it had effect. And, you know, their plan was, once the medicine kicks in, we're going to uncuff him, put him in the bed, then we'll soft point restrain him to the bed. So they did, and they wanted to wait till the, you know, ketamine took effect. But by the time he was placed on the gurney, you know, Mr. McCain, because they'd been given a lot of ketamine, had no muscle tone, was limp, and had visible vomit coming from his mouth and nose. Now, this is always, like, there's always a point in these stories where I'm like, I can buy the stuff up until a certain point, but when he has, you know, as a paramedic in New Jersey, we use ketamine fairly often for, you know, rapid sequence intubation. And, you know, when you give somebody a dissociative anesthetic or a paralytic, you have to monitor their airway like a crazy person, right? So he had vomit coming from his mouth and nose. He was snoring. Once they loaded him into the ambulance, they discovered he had no pulse and was not breathing. They performed CPR, they intubated him, they gave him epi, and they put an IO and gave him epi, and he had a pulse. But then he actually died on August 27, 2019. He was declared being brain dead then, and life support was discontinued. So this was another one of those calls where, you know, we've all probably been there, where things just don't go right. You know, it's very hard to estimate somebody's weight effectively. We don't have a scale. So being off, you know, this is actually one of the things this case made me think about months ago, was we don't ever test like medic students and medics about the ability to successfully guess somebody's weight. And I don't know why. We have also no mechanism to measure anybody's weight either. Which,
I know, we haven't gotten those weighted beds yet, so.
And, you know, you laugh, but there probably could be a system devised that would actually weigh somebody, give us a better estimate.
Like a two-way Braslow for adults, like it has weight and circumference or something?
A Braslow, or there's a bunch of different, you know, types of scales we could probably come up with that are measured in a number of different ways. So
can I interject here?
Sure.
I'm hung up on this, Scott. So they gave some other medics ketamine? Like, yeah. That's what I don't get. Like, if they're my narcotics, I'm the one giving them.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I have a, that's actually the hardest part for me to digest, is that someone else's ketamine these guys gave in, like, I, you know, out of context, whatever you want to call it. And then they were convicted, but it's like, what were the other medics doing that were like, here, take my ketamine? I just find that strange.
In Colorado and California, you have a system where the municipal or county fire department paramedics are technically in charge of the private ambulance paramedics. So I'm not sure that's the case here. That does, however, seem to be a common way things work different places.
Right. So, I mean, if they have like a lockbox or something, that's the ambulance's lockbox of drugs, and they're not assigned to a paramedic, maybe it's not in like a fanny pack or something, then that would kind of make a little more sense. Because just like, you know, if you didn't have an EpiPen in the first responder or something, and the ambulance came and the EpiPen was in there, like, I guess that would kind of make sense for you to, you know, help yourself to whatever the ambulance arrived with.
But I agree with you. It doesn't really make much sense, especially if they're in the Falk ambulance, that perhaps the Falk crew should be giving that, taking care of it. Now, I mean, does it mean it wouldn't turn out the same way? No, it might. But listen, I'm sure the Aurora fire medics are kicking themselves for this. So here's part of the reason why this case got me, is that they threw the kitchen sink at these two medics. So the Falk medics, oh wait, the Falk medics are here too, aren't they? They're here too.
So if we go over, you know, like the whole negligence thing, or gross negligence, if you can have those pretty easily. I mean, if you just make a mistake, that could be negligence. If you make a bad mistake or a big mistake, that could be gross negligence. Like a drug calculation that's like 500 times the dose, that would be like gross negligence, or five times the dose. But what I don't follow is the intent, because it's always really hard to prove intent, because it's so internal, you know, that they intended to do, you know, mal acts for this patient. You know, I struggle to see how they were able to prove that.
Well, they haven't, in this case hasn't gone to trial yet, so they haven't proved anything yet. So they've been charged. But when you go through what they've been charged with, so they've been charged with criminally negligent homicide. They've been charged with assault in the second degree with intent to cause bodily injury to Elijah McCain.
Yeah, see, I don't get the whole intent thing. How that would be hard to prove.
They've been charged with conspiracy to commit or immediate flight from the crime of assault in the second degree. They've been charged with there's one here. I have to scroll down because there's like everybody got hit with like eight charges. They've been charged with unlawfully using or possessing or threatening the use of a deadly weapon, namely ketamine, during the attempted commission of conspiracy to commit, or they made a flight from the offense of assault in second degree, which is weird because this is like bootstrapping, right? So ketamine is not a deadly weapon in the context of this supposed assault until it's actually, you know, used. And then it becomes an agent. So it's like a knife isn't a weapon until you use it as a weapon. They charge him with unlawful, feloniously, and for the purpose other than lawful medical or therapeutic treatment, intentionally cause stupor, unconsciousness, or other physical or mental impairment or injury to Elijah McCain by administering a drug substance or preparation capable of producing intended harm without Elijah McCain's consent. So as you go through these, you're like, this is the entire kitchen sink they're throwing at them. You know, you can't get...
It's like a copy-paste job, like all the bad things, copy-paste. You did everything wrong. Yeah, it's a bit much. And I mean, I'm not justifying their behavior or their acts like in any way. I'm just saying like, maybe they could have just picked the strongest one, because I feel like I don't understand why they need all of these, but maybe that makes it a stronger case so that maybe they only get one or two of them.
It doesn't make it a stronger case. It does two things. The first thing it does is it allows the jury to say, if we're not going to convict the paramedics of criminally negligent homicide, we have a lesser charge we can convict them on. That's one. It gives them a fallback. The second thing it gives them is bargaining chips for plea agreements. So part of the reason why almost everybody pleads out in federal court is not because everybody's guilty in federal court. It's because the federal government just hits you with like multiple hammers and threatens to send you to jail for life.
Right. So people just take the better option, even if it's still a bad option.
Yeah. And that's why like 90%+ of all federal criminal cases end in a plea deal. Because they just, and they have a limited resources to throw at it. So, even if you're a rich person, they can just bankrupt you basically by keeping the trial going. Once again, this is a case where they misjudged the patient's weight. They didn't do, they'll say the charge is that they didn't perform an appropriate assessment. And I think somewhere in here, it says they didn't actually effectively monitor him before all this happened. Now, the problem is, if he had been fighting, it's very hard to perform an independent assessment of someone when they're fighting. Miscalculating the weight, they weren't off by 5 pounds, they were off by a significant amount, and the failure to monitor him is probably the thing that's the most reasonable. But once again, we're stuck with the outcome is going to produce consequences. So it's a horrible thing that happened to Elijah McCain. It's, ruined the lives of, obviously cost Elijah McCain his life. It obviously was not what these police officers, these paramedics wanted to happen, when they came to work that day. But regardless of the actual case, the guilt, the actual guilt, the responsibility, which we will find out when this case is tried, it's going to have implications for the system, right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to have implications for how patients get treated. It's going to have, the weight problem is actually the one that is probably the most worrisome, because we don't have an accurate and effective way to weigh patients now. And
it'd be interesting too to see like the where it says about the cops restraining him in some way or like doing this carotid suppression. Like if they responded to excited delirium and they thought that's what it was, it could have been hypoxia. And who caused that hypoxia? So like it's like a domino effect. So I'm kind of surprised that it wasn't like a joint conviction or like they didn't look at the cops as well, especially with the political climate,
The cops here are charged as well in this case.
Okay.
The problem is we're going to end up with the outcomes. Like I said, people make reasonable decisions based upon these events. And if they're convicted, you're going to see paramedics are going to refuse to treat patients because they're not absolutely sure what the patient's weight is. And you're going to see paramedics refuse to treat excited delirium or patients who are severely agitated and say, this is a law enforcement problem, I'm not getting involved.
Mm-hmm. You might even have them pull drugs from the formulary.
They already have in Colorado. They already Aurora pulled ketamine, and there was a law introduced. I'm not talking out of my butt, but I'm not. I don't have the facts in front of me. That I think Colorado introduced a law to ban paramedic use of ketamine, which is, I'm not going to say it's crazy, but I will say that ketamine is hands down one of the more useful drugs that paramedics carry and use. And
but legally speaking, they're going to say, well, it's not worth it to have there if you have other drugs that can do some of the same things, even if they're different drugs.
Yeah, but they're not. But honestly, they're not as safe as ketamine. So
when they're dosed appropriately, but they might just say, well, you could just Haldol them. You know what I mean? Like, so they're just going to justify it with like the path of least resistance, even if there are really good reasons to use ketamine.
Yeah. I mean, in New Jersey, we have three different induction drugs we typically use, but almost exclusively people tend to use ketamine because it's so much safer than the other two. So, I mean, there's already been moves to ban ketamine as a medication, which is short-sighted. But I think you're going to see more paramedics just refusing to use stuff if they can't weigh patients.
Right. I guess that's fair.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the benefits of ketamine is it usually doesn't cause respiratory depression. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. But there's a difference between, snowing someone with ketamine for sedation for an RSI and using it to control a behavioral emergency.
Because I agree. Those are two different things.
Like when we teach ACLS and PALS at my hospital, a lot of the nurses come in and a lot of them complain about ketamine because they say that it's fine pre-hospitally, but then when they have to watch them after a behavioral emergency, they start hallucinating and they have like a lot of after effects.
Yeah, they do.
So it's kind of like, I could kind of see both sides of it. Like I could really see the use of the drug, especially, for certain medical conditions where it has other properties, depending on the dosing and, the mechanism of action. But I think that there's something to be said for, if you're RSIing someone, you have a lot more to gain and a lot less to lose than if you're using it for a behavioral emergency.
Yeah, I think that legislators will want to, and they've they're trying this. I don't think it happened in Colorado. They're going to want to try to ban ketamine, but I think what you'll find a lot more in Colorado and other places, it's a national issue, is you'll see that paramedics will just say, if you're going to fight with them, go ahead and fight with them. Right? I'm not going to, chemically sedate them. And this is the outcome that's being driven by criminally charging these medics. I don't know whether it's right or wrong, right? That, you could say there, I think you could, if somebody said there's a role for chemical sedation, rather than being involved in a violent conflict, this is the whole point. This is why we have pepper spray and why we have less than lethal bullets, rubber bullets, is because the theory is that you want to avoid shooting people because that's way worse for them than, pepper spray or rubber bullets. By the same token, might be better for you to be chemically sedated than get into a knockdown, drag out fight with, 10 burly cops.
Absolutely. I mean, I've definitely been in situations where I've been called to sedate patients and I didn't sedate them because sometimes people just reach their limit with them. They're just like, I can't do anything. I can't convince them to get in the cop car, but you need to sedate them. I'm like, okay, let me see if I need to sedate them. And then I don't, contextual. When you're not there, it's hard.
Yeah. But this is the outcome though. The outcome is you're going to have more people who are being arrested, get more hurt than they would have before. And to some token, the paramedic answer is that's really not my responsibility. Sorry, but it's not my responsibility. But I think that's the outcome. And so, like I said, I don't have a strong opinion about it one way or the other. I think that we'll see how that happens. And then so this is what prosecutors get when they charge the paramedics.
You're gonna get both intended consequences and unintended consequences of any decisions that are made like this.
So now the other thing here, and this is the thing that I think is actually, there's a bunch of things that tie two of these cases together, obviously. But this is the one other big issue, is the indictment states that the paramedics deviated from the standard protocols governing when to administer ketamine such that the administration of ketamine was unlawful. So what this is saying is that any deviation from clinical protocols can create a situation where what we do is unlawful. So what this is going to do is it's going to create a situation where it's going to be textbook medicine, cookbook medicine, where you're not going to be saying we're going to do this or not do this. We didn't follow the recipe. So regardless of what the individual patient needs, we're going to follow the recipe. Because any sort of discretion, any sort of deviation from the recipe can make it a criminal act. So you're going to have, I work, New Jersey is just very different than most other places. We actually, like I've said this before, we call telemetry and speak to a physician on every single call. So for us, it's actually probably less of a threat. But for most of the country, where paramedics function almost exclusively under written clinical protocols, this is going to create a huge backlash against paramedics engaging in any degree of clinical judgment, and they're just going to follow what the protocol says, regardless of what the patient needs. And if they do deviate, if the medical directors do rewrite the protocols so that there is, if you embed the clinical judgment into the protocol explicitly, maybe you'll have, maybe you can write your way out of it. But I don't think most protocols are going to be written in a way that's going to build in the ability to tailor care to the actual patient.
I'm wondering though, that definitely opens a big door that we might not want to open. As far as, the legal implications for medical care, like we're saying, and that's what they kind of have in common. But I'm wondering too, how far they're stretching it. So for the Colorado case, is ketamine an option for sedation for behavioral emergencies under that protocol? Or is it exclusively for RSI? And did they choose now to use it for sedation? And do they mix up the dose because they don't dose it typically for behavioral emergencies? They dose it for sedation for RSI.
From reading everything about this case I've seen so far, they didn't call and speak to a physician. Mm-hmm. I don't think they did. Let's go back.
Because I know where I work, we don't have ketamine for behavioral emergencies, but it might be an RSI option. So stretching the protocol that far, I could sort of see a little bit more than if it was an option and they just overdosed it for that option that they had as standing orders. Sort of like the C-section from New Jersey, not a while ago, where it's like, it's not that the patient didn't need a C-section. It's just that's not your protocol. You can't do a C-section. You know what I mean?
Well, like, I'll defend that one. The problem is, this wasn't the case then, but it is the case now, that perimortem C-section needed, everybody agrees that perimortem C-section needs to be done within a matter of minutes. And for a patient in cardiac arrest, in order to give the patient, not the baby, the patient, the best chance of survival, perimortem C-section is the appropriate therapy for a mother in cardiac arrest with a full-term infant. In defense of them as well, the baby did live for at least a day, and they did call and speak to the physician before they did it. They didn't just do it on their own.
Right.
And it was that's another one of those situations where I wasn't there. It's a very tough situation. If you wait the 15 minutes to get to the hospital, the window of time for successful resuscitation has passed. So basically, by your choice is either to call and speak to the physician and then do something that has a chance of success for the mother or baby, or provide routine paramedic care and transport the mother with CPR to the hospital, knowing that in that instance, neither the mother nor the baby will survive. And that's really the choice.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the case in particular, just the, you know, overall story, but I'm wondering, yeah, like, I mean, we would teach an ACLS to have, you know, good resuscitation on the mother, and that would
put no. It's actually in the circulation bulletin under special circumstances. You can go look it up.
Right.
Perimortem C-section is in ACLS. Not how to do it.
For physicians, but like, it's just weird because if you did left lateral uterine displacement for a pregnant female while you're doing CPR, well, I guess that would be harder in EMS, obviously, if you don't have a second person in the back. But I'm just wondering how that plays in, like if that was the alternative option or not for them, or if that would even work as well to perfuse.
That is the alternative option. However, in ACLS, under special circumstances, they do discuss perimortem C-section in the presence of full-term infant in the presence of maternal cardiac arrest. So you're getting me on my soapbox here. The problem with perimortem C-section is not a question of does it need to be done, because that's not in question. Perimortem C-section needs to be done when you have, you know, a mother with a full-term infant in cardiac arrest. You do need to do a perimortem C-section in order to give the mother the best chance of survival. The question is, who's going to do it? What setting they're going to do it in? And do you have a system to deliver that care in the 5 to 10 minutes post-arrest that is suggested is the appropriate window for performing it? Now, if you look at the circulation bulletin for special circumstances, they make a pretty significant point that should be done in the ER unless the patient can immediately go to the OR. But even there, it's outside the window of where it's going to be effective. So
yeah, I get that.
When I was state EMS director, the question, like that was my question, was, you know, we could, one solution is delivering a pre-hospital physician to the scene effectively for those situations. Another situation is delivering a mid-level practitioner. The third situation is training paramedics how to do something or doing it with video oversight of an obstetrician or an emergency physician. You know, there was no solution. It was one of those, it doesn't happen very often. It happens. Right. It happens often enough to, you know, become a special paper, but it doesn't happen altogether that often.
Well, the gravity is different too. Like if you're administering a life-saving treatment in which there's no alternative, better option in sight, and you have medical data to back it up, that it's easier to defend that to stop someone from being convicted, especially like, let's say you're at the end of your career, this is your last call, right, and you have the ability to make a difference. I mean, if you as a provider, a healthcare provider, want to make that call, you're taking your own risk, right, into your own hands, and you're choosing to do that.
Those paramedics in that situation weren't convicted. One of them had their license revoked and the other one did.
Right. So they chose to take the risk, and I'm sure they probably have reasons for why it was or wasn't worth it, right? But these guys in the cases that we're discussing today, the first guys, I think it was a major oversight. And it was a bad transport decision.
Yeah.
The question I like to ask if I was, you know, called in as the expert witness or something would be, should these people not be out on the road anymore? Like, was what they did so terrible that they should not be paramedics anymore? Because that's ultimately going to be the consequence, whether they like it or not, right? Because that either the reputation's going to be damaged or the license is going to be taken away or you're going to go to jail. So if you think they shouldn't be on the road anymore, then maybe the criminal conviction justifies, you know, what happened. I don't necessarily think that's the case in the first one. I think it might be the case in the second one, especially if they chose to use ketamine, if it wasn't indicated for behavioral emergencies at all whatsoever, and they had other options available.
But here's the problem.
You know,
we're stuck in a catch-22 here. And this, listen, I'm pretty sure you've heard my pediatric intubation rant about the Los Angeles and Orange County intubation study. The problem is that systems are cheap and they don't want to invest in ongoing clinical competency. And so you can blame the clinician, and that's very easy to do. It's very easy to make the clinician the bad guy. But the truth is that in both of these situations, you've got people who were doing things they didn't do a whole lot. That's my assumption for the second. I know it's the case for the first. So these, you didn't have the highest level of paramedics on this job. In the Hamilton case, they had not seen a whole bunch of shootings in their career. And presumably they hadn't been engaged in an ongoing clinical competency model where that was focused, because that wasn't what I guess that Hamilton Paramedic Service doesn't see a whole lot of trauma from shootings in particular. In this situation with the Colorado paramedics, I'm not sure how long these folks have been paramedics, but I do know that they weren't very good at assessing weight, and we don't actually focus on that in EMS education or EMS continuing education. So
yeah, if we were substituting that reasonable paramedic in the same circumstance thing, it would be really hard to prove that you'd have a better gauge on weight as another reasonable paramedic, because we don't train.
Right. And this is the problem, is that, you know, instead of saying, you know, instead of blaming the system, and this is actually, if you're involved with any sort of safety or risk stuff, they're always about trying to identify the systemic problems, not the individual problems. These people made mistakes because of the systems they work in. They didn't make mistakes because they were bad people. Nobody in either of these cases is saying that any of the paramedics acted in a malicious way. They're saying that they made mistakes, and the mistakes were so big and so egregious that they deviated from the normal standards. Like in the second case, they've just been indicted, so prosecutors can say whatever they want. The second case, they've been convicted. So, but in both cases, you're stuck with the same point. The problems that happened were because they weren't the focus of the system to eliminate those problems. You know, how many, the question I would have for this Aurora case is, how many other patients had a clinically significant deviation in their weight assessment over the last year? And that's
absolutely.
And that's the thing I really would want to, that's the question I'd want to know if I was in charge of that, the Aurora EMS system, is how bad are we at this? Who else is it impacted? And how do we change it so we get better at that? But yet instead, we're stuck with a situation.
Yeah, because what happened to QA? Like, it's supposed to be non-punitive, right? So you're like, where is QA in all this? And how come that's not the first?
But that's what's going to happen, though, is that, you know, systems will not. Listen, I can promise you, Aurora Fire Department has not pulled all of their charts for the past year where they gave a weight-based drug and then actually asked the hospital, what was the weight of all those patients? And the reason they wouldn't do that is because that creates an enormous amount of liability for the fire department to ask that question. So they might try to get that information other ways, but they'll never ask that up front of all the hospital systems, because they might find out they have a major problem and find out they have 1,000 patients who received an inappropriate dosage of medication. So they wouldn't even, so a smart system who had an attorney, the attorney would tell them, do you really want to ask this question? This is going to open Pandora's box. Don't ask questions you don't already know the answer to. So this is why I want to talk about these two cases, because it's not that the tragedy of what happened in both isn't important, it is. It's how these cases impact not only these individual systems, but how these cases impact the EMS system as a whole. And I thought it was very interesting that you heard a lot of talk over the past week about the indictments in Colorado and almost no talk about the conviction of the two paramedics in Hamilton, Ontario. And honestly, Hamilton, Ontario is 300 miles from New York City. It's not far away. It's not somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. It is, you know, literally right at the edge of the GTA. And it's, you know, a pretty normal suburban place to work. You know, it's like a lot of places in the United States. So, you know, everything has, every decision, every outcome has a result. And I think we're going to start seeing a lot of changes to EMS very soon. And listen, you know, I teach paramedics for a living now. And I work as a paramedic one day a week, one day every other week. But, you know, what do I tell my paramedic students about this? The weight issue, that's a perfect example. I tell them, you know, all I can tell them is we have no mechanism for measuring weight and there was a criminal indictment based upon them getting the weight wrong. That's not a good way to attract
people. We already have a problem, you know, convincing people to take this whole thing on as a paramedic. And we're like, just kidding, you might actually just go to jail if you dose someone wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You know, the only good part is that New Jersey, at least they're paid a reasonable salary. You know, you go upstate New York where they're making $15 an hour. How do you get someone to take a job, you know, where you might go to jail for $15 an hour?
Well, we're seeing that with the vaccine mandate right now up way upstate where people are just leaving the healthcare profession because they're saying, well, I could just get paid to do something else where I'm not going to get told to get the vaccine. Although that'll be short.
But I guess that fell through, since every employer with more than 100 people is going to require it, huh?
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, like I just saw an article saying Ellis Hospital isn't delivering babies anymore because their L&D nurse staff left. So they have no way to do it. I mean, there's going to, again, these are unintended consequences of this New York State mandate. So it's always interesting to see how these unintended consequences develop, you know, and that's definitely going to be one of them with the dosing where it's, you know, what does that mean for our new paramedics and what do we tell them in regard to what can happen to them Because if we're just going to go by the textbook definition in the US, with the national curriculum saying, oh, yeah, you know, you have to have malintent. And if, as long as you don't have malintent, like, you know, you, as long as you act reasonably, it's better to do something than to not to do something. Well, this is not that. So
we will see. Although most paramedics in most states are usually held to a simple negligence standard. There's just not that many cases against them. So, well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I liked law school, why I was interested in becoming a lawyer, is that both because I was interested in law and interested in policy and outcomes. And this is a great example of how we're going to end up with, we're going to get what we get based upon these sorts of decisions that come out of it. All right, any final words, Maria? It was hot as heck today. We had three days of nice weather, and now it was like miserable today.
Yeah, I didn't spend any time outside, but I've heard it's pretty rough today.
Yeah, I'm ready for fall. All right, with that said, next week after, whenever we come up with a new topic, Maria, I will talk to you soon.
All right, Scott.
Bye.